Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is a Heart and Hand production.
We're gonna shout to the top, shout.
Our need for icons, heroes and saviours may be innately human, but it never ever provides us with the proper perspective. The story of Rangers season 1986-87 is really one of influence more than mercenary expediency. It's about the increased contribution from older faces as much as it was about the glittering performance from new ones. This famous success would not have been possible without the weight of goals from Ally McCoys and Robert Fleck and the odd crucial one from Dave McPherson. The consistent reliability of Stuart Munro and the maverick uncertainty of Ted McMinn, the dynamic energy of young talent like Ian Durrant and Derek Ferguson, as well as the new life that was breathed into the fading light of Davy Cooper. Terry Butcher and Chris Woods were almost ever present, but Graham Souness played only half the games that season and Graham Roberts just a third. Rangers built new foundations in the summer of 1986, but it wasn't an oligarch-fuelled refit with a shiny new player for every position. In an 11-a-side sport, there's only so much impact that three or four men can have in a single match. The potential impact they can have on their teammates, however, is almost limitless. Rangers 1986-87 is not a story about how a handful of professional footballers changed a handful of games. It's about how they changed an entire culture. Joining me to discuss that first part of the story is Mr. Andy McGowan. How are you, Andy?
I'm very good, man. Delighted to be on your new flagship show. Very exciting times.
Delighted to have you. And Alan Bradley, welcome, Alan. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, Martin. And like Andy, just delighted to be on. Been through a hang of a time, obviously, leading up to that one. So it's just going to be so good talking about so many positives, you know, ultimately dominating Scottish football. And probably after the maybe 7 or 8 years preceding that one, bring it on, please, yeah.
Well, let's get started then. This part of the series, 86 to 98, this first season is called Ignition. That's really how I see this story kind of being, that the influence that Souness, of course, and Smith, and those crucial signings had on the rest, the influence they had on the rest of that dressing room. That dressing room then, Alan, in the April of 1986, which is where we left off last week with John and David, and Souness's appointment being made public, and Jock Wallace being let go. Walter Smith, in his book, talks about the disappointment he felt on arriving, just the state of the dressing room, the state of how things were done, the strips, the training gear just left in a pile, and they were just dried. They weren't washed, so they'd be kind of cardboard stiff when they were put out again. It shattered the illusions that he had that Rangers would be the best of the best. Kind of Rangers class, as men of that generation would call it. A kind of aura had vanished from Rangers by 1986, hadn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And as you say, that aura had kind of way back to, probably Struth, obviously through Scott Simon and so on. I only picked that up, obviously, reading it, Martin, but yeah, it certainly had gone. There's a lot of good players. There were still some decent players, as obviously we'll see going forward, but the standards definitely dropped. And again, we'll get on to it once Graeme Souness and Walter Smith come in. We fairly quickly managed to, return to some of those old Rangers, the sort of qualities and the way we should carry ourselves and just the level of our professionalism. Now, I don't know as well when we looked into, obviously, the Wallace stuff near the end, and I know Big Joke Wallace says himself that in that last season, the illness was beginning to impact on him, with all of the stress, the way things were going. He didn't have that same, kind of up and at him, the fight about him. He felt quite sort of down, and he felt there was a wee bit of an impact. So I don't know if maybe there was a wee bit of that that obviously crept into, how things were going. Because certainly prior to that, when it would have appeared that Rangers, certainly a few years before, would still have had some of those good standards. But you're right, at that point in time, really reading what, Walter said about it, my goodness, we needed something, Martin.
Okay, so Wallace is gone, but Alex Totten remains in charge because the plan is that Souness is going to come in the summer. He's still got his contract left at Sampdoria, and Smith is still the assistant manager at Dundee United. Rangers are in a dogfight for fifth spot, and a fifth spot will get UEFA Cup football next year. They're in this fight with Dundee. 12th of April, Rangers go to Clydebank, and as we'll go through 86-87, the season that follows. The absolute whipping boys for Rangers. They were a very convenient team to play. But Rangers lose 2-1 at Kilbowie, and really plunging this into serious jeopardy. A decision was made. Totten, who was placed in an unfair position, really, along with John Haggart and Stan Anderson, were let go. And a deal was done for Smith. I think we had to pay some of the £50,000 compensation, which Walt Smith was raging at, because McLean had spent about $7,000 to take him from Dumbarton or whatever. but it was done quickly. It was done very businessmanlike by David Holmes. But you were at Kilbowie that day. You were very young, of course, at the time, but your memories of what you were seeing, and I guess what the handful of games that were left perhaps told you.
Yeah, so I'm 10-year-old, so you've got to put my recollections in context. I was 10-year-old, but I remember this vividly. And the fact that, that sense you've said there, Martin, they were fighting for fifth to get into Europe. Two remarkable things: the fact that fifth got you into Europe, but also that was where we are. I think Alan's been kind. I think we were a joke at that point. Everything had been eroded to the point where we were in an afterthought. There was no chance of us winning the league. We got excited that this season we're talking about, when we won, the first 10 games, we were top of the league. There was no heroes for me, is my recollection. When you look through that squad then, Davey Cooper was the only guy that I would say was a hero. You had Derek Ferguson and Ian Durant as young, promising, up-and-coming players, but there was nobody there that was a talisman apart from Cooper. And as you say,
Ali?
Well, my recollection was he was scoring loads of goals, but the jury was still out on him. And whether that's just classic Rangers unfair fight. Rangers supports, looking for perfection in a young player, I don't know. But I certainly know the Alan McCoys we think of now, or we think through the glory years. It was I don't think there was much leeway or goodwill given to many of these players because
it wasn't working.
They were failing more often than succeeding, to be honest, with the odd League Cup win here or there. But that game you speak of at Clydebank, I remember it vividly because it was an exciting time and you were waiting for what was next because you knew something big was going to happen. You knew there was an explosion going to happen. We didn't know the details of how. You were in this bit of limbo because you had Souness and Italy still playing for Sampdoria. you had the World Cup coming up, which he was going to, so you had the kind of crazy prospect of a Rangers manager, or a player manager, playing at a World Cup and captaining your country. So it was so exciting, so new, so fresh. The concept of player manager was something that wasn't really done. I'm trying to think of who elsewhere would have had at that point in time in British football as a player manager. And we're going to Clyde Bank and you're going to Old Kilbury with the wooden benches. And that day before we went in, the bus went by and I got a wave off David Cooper. That's how I remember it. And that's how I started to think, you know, he was the only guy I wanted a wave off of. And it was just a disastrous game. And there was no protest or howl of derision because it was a shock result, but it wasn't a shock result, if that makes sense, because this squad had run the race. Yeah. And really, you're looking at them saying, you'll not be here. We thought a clear out was in the cards, and the press at that time were full of sensational first 11s that we might have, and, you know, all the best players for England, and guys like Liam Brady and Phil Kyle, and crazy talk in the paper, so that your imagination was allowed to run riot, because this was the kind of idea of what was going to happen next. But disastrous result, and as you say, it hastened the end for Taunton. I didn't know at the time, but you're absolutely correct. Really unfair on Taunton. I mean, Taunton went on to prove himself as an exceptionally good manager, and he was Rangers through and through, as my understanding, and it caught him deep. But it was, you know, we had to qualify for Europe, so you know, it was desperation stakes after that result.
Yeah, Smith's first game in charge was another defeat away to St Mirren at Love Street, 2-1, which put us behind Dundee in the race for this European spot. He brought in Don Mackay, former Coventry City and Dundee manager, as a bit of experience in there to assist with the crucial final fortnight. And the next game could not have been less attractive. Rangers' record at this point at Pittodrie was the stuff of nightmares. One win in the previous 25 visits that included 17 defeats. And we're in a position now, Alan, where Rangers couldn't afford to lose, certainly, and going to Aberdeen was just the last place you would go. But Rangers drew 1-1, were pegged back. A brilliant Ted McMahon goal put Rangers ahead. By all accounts, a very impressive performance. And an early sign, I guess, of Walter Smith's quiet, calm assurance. He talked about the performance from David Cooper that day. He said, look, you know, there are good players at this club, but they just need confidence, and Davies basically one of those.
Yeah, that's the point that I wanted to make. Even if you look at the team, I take Andy's point about the way things had gone with results and so on. They'd managed to raise their game every now and then. For example, even the 4-each one, I know some people are against Celtic and so on, but there were players there. If you look at them, there was McCoy's to, 25 goals in amongst a pretty poor team, I still think's no bad. You've got Stuart Munro, you've got Ted McMahon, McPherson, Robert Fleck will go on as well, Durant, Derek Ferguson. So my point is there were still some good players which we'll put to use, you know, in the year after that one as well, obviously with the different management in it and the standards being raised. But aye, Pittodrie, going back to that one, I don't know how many times we went up there. I think it was something like 17 times. But we were continually, it was a bit like the times where, mind, we wouldn't win at Parkhead in 9 years, or, do you know what I mean,
yeah,
in 9 visits.
Yeah, a bad one, yeah.
But we did, as you say, we actually, and it probably would have been, you know, the kind of Walter Smith, the way they did it. But I do remember battering them. I think they equalised quite late on, Martin,
yeah, Hewitt,
to be honest
yeah.
with you. And then obviously all from there, it then goes down to, I think Motherwell obviously we played in the last game of the season. And that was a strange one too, because obviously we managed to go through. I think that was the same time that Dundee, they managed to beat Hearts.
Well, Dundee had lost, with the Aberdeen game, Dundee had lost at Celtic, so Rangers were back in pole position. Rangers played Motherwell on the final day. We won 2-0. Yeah. McCoys and McPherson scored. This is Graeme Souness is now in charge, by the way. This is Souness' first official game. But
that was the Dundee one where Dundee obviously against Hearts up there, the Albert Kidd thingy.
Yeah.
But I remember it was a strange one too, and it's kind of quite like Andy said too. In one bit you're going, well, that's good, we're in Europe. But to be honest with you, being a Rangers fan, it was like they've won the league. it just seems strange. But we had this excitement knowing, look, Souness is coming. We've obviously got Smith. And as Andy said at the time as well, we're thinking, who else are we going to get in terms of different players? So, but I remember that was a weird one. I think the crowd actually increased a wee bit.
21,000 on that day, Alan. Highest of the season, I think, or certainly one of the highest of the season. It was the biggest crowd of the day in Scotland, certainly. But still a half full Ibrox. So weren't quite tempting you all back in thousands, but that would come. So Rangers get the job done. But as you've intimated there, Alan, you know, Dundee did win. They beat Hearts, which on the final day gave Celtic the title. And it's funny that you mentioned the supporters feeling a sense of mixed feeling. So did the Rangers players, and Souness couldn't quite understand the dressing room being so despondent. Said, "Well, you've done your first job. You've qualified for Europe. This is important." But he wasn't steeped in this. He didn't understand that kind of duality. But he would have a chance very quickly to properly understand it, because the next weekend or the Friday night was the Glasgow Cup final. Now, as it is now, but as it was at the time, a bit of a sideshow. Quite a lot of youth players would be played there, but it was decided that they, you know, both Rangers and Celtic would give it a good bash in terms of the teams that they put out. Graeme Souness is in a dugout. Celtic are just the champions. 40,000 made their way to Ibrox that night. Traffic chaos. One Rangers player got caught up in that traffic, a certain Mr. McCoist, who not exactly known for his punctuality anyway. Rangers won 3-2. McCoist hat-trick, the winner, extra time, 25 yards, just an alley goal. Maybe turning in, Andy, to the kind of player that we kind of come to know, although, of course, he scored that hat-trick in the 84 League Cup final. I'll ask you about the game in a minute, Alan, but what I found interesting, just doing the research for the book, Davy Hay that week, remember, now champion of Scotland, talks about a new Old Firm era, not a new Celtic era. All the signs, he says, that ourselves and Rangers can go on from here to bigger and better things, and it's an exciting time for the Old Firm in general. Now, he wasn't wrong. No other club would win a league title since then. But it told me how indicative that was of the threat that they felt immediately, talking about Rangers as title rivals, when we had not bothered a title race in the best part of a decade. That kind of, I found that really, really telling, that when he's just won a league championship, that he would be talking about Rangers and Celtic being the big ticket next year.
Yeah, and I think even the media training, even if personally I'd thought about that one, I don't know if you'd been the other side. If it'd been our manager, we would have been wanting, well, quite frankly, we've just won the league, we're going on to better things, there's going to be a challenge, but we'll just
you wouldn't
take care
mention
of it. Such a strange thing to come out with. Yeah.
What about the game? I don't want to focus too much time on a friendly, but I mean, Walter Smith certainly, again, writes how important that was, just psychologically, and it told them what could be done with energy, and energy from the fans, energy from around the ground and these players. Seems a good game by all accounts.
It was a great atmosphere. I think I actually had been married in the January of that year, so took Margaret to her first Old Firm game, and we were in the Govan, pretty much at the Copeland, you know, the Govan rear, but pretty much towards the Copeland. And again, she was just watching, but the atmosphere was brilliant. Funnily enough, I talked before, I think when I've spoken to you guys and Who Are You, about embarrassing moment. My embarrassing moment was after a few minutes, Rangers having a chance, the ball dropping to McCoist, and just like Andy had said, and me standing up, McCoist not finishing and calling a posing so-and-so, and looking at Margaret as if, hey, I know a bit about football, and sat down. Now, obviously, at the end of the game, she was going, that was that chap you they were shouting at, Alan. And I think that said a lot. I think Andy's right. From the word go, even with Ali McCoist, even early on, if he scored at Parkhead in his first one, there was that kind of mixed feeling about him. I don't know, but as I say, that was my most embarrassing moment. But yeah, the game, we scored early. I think McCoist for Hugh Burns. Brian McClure got one just before half-time. We get another one 76 minutes. And then Mo Johnson equalised right near the end. I remember, because into extra time, I can mind Shuggy Burns going down with cramp and so on, but Rangers really played so well, and the atmosphere, I mean, Ibrox was bouncing that night, and to actually win it, really strange, because again, a bit like the kind of Motherwell one, but with this one, it was like, well, that's fine, they've won the league now, but it really set, I feel, a marker psychologically as well for, look, we're going to get better now. You know, you had won the league, and I think psychologically too with Celtic, whether that ended up coming the Davy Hay one, but I think it must have fit them as, geez, you know, they've just played us off the park here. And by the way, the Celtic team was pretty much the first team.
Yeah, both sides really, really went for it. Moved to the Friday night, not to overshadow the Scottish Cup final the following day.
I think it was St Mirren, was it Ian Ferguson?
No, it was Hearts' capitulation being complete when they were battered by Aberdeen. They were going for a double and fell down the last 2 days. But early that day, Rangers fire, basically, or certainly let go. Derek Johnson, Dave McKinnon, Billy Davis, Andy Bruce, Eric Ferguson, John McDonald and Dougie Bell are told they're on the transfer list. McDonald would go to Barnsley, but Dougie Bell would remain there for the rest of the season. And I guess, technically, as soon as his first signing, if you don't include himself, was the extension of Ali McCoy's contract that night. It was supposed to be done before the game, but as I said, he was late. And I guess a hat-trick maybe added a wee bit of value on there. He pretended that he wasn't going to do it. He wasn't going to sign and then cracked the jokes. And I think David Holmes says, look, Ali, would you just sign this and let me go to my bed? It's been a long day. There was never any question of doing that. Andy, you mentioned the speculation starting pretty early. It would only increase in the summer, but it wasn't just confined to the likes of the Daily Record and the Evening Times and Glasgow, basically. Because, incredibly, on this greatest show on earth, the World Cup, the old Glasgow Rangers were being talked about in various camps around the competition. Because, you know, the thinking was that the net was going to be spread far and wide. Clearly, it would be in the Scotland camp because you've got Walter Smith in the, you know, the staff there, soon as the captain. Richard Goff was a big target, and he was there, but I think Goff and Smith knew that was never going to be a goer. Jim McLean was simply not going to sell to a rival. The Catholic thing had come up immediately at the soon as press conference, and Chick Young had got some time with soon as on the plane to Santa Fe. And he gave quite a revealing kind of interview. He's like, you know, what do they want? Do they, you know, they want a sectarian team or do they want a successful one? You know, I will sign a Catholic player. It could have been very quickly done, couldn't it? Ali Dick of Spurs was the one that was very close to happening. He started, or his family started to talk about it, and Souness wasn't impressed with that and shut it down.
Yep, Souness ripped up the rules. And you're talking about Davy Hay there and him referencing the kind of, it's almost as if he's attaching themselves to our coattails because it was that seismic. And I can only, I'm trying to think of a kind of comparison so that younger listeners get it. It was like being taken over by Arab sheiks without the sheiks because Souness was such a massive name. It was such a massive statement of intent. And it was just a case of we're going to go big very, very quickly. And I know in transfer-wise, I mean, it wasn't much of a bar to blow up because your transfer business had been very, very modest for a long, long time. And it was quite laughable that Celtic got the biscuit tin kind of badge because we were pretty much the same, weren't we? We wouldn't keep John McClelland. We wouldn't pay more money for, you know, players that went on to cause us great harm. And so it was as if the shackles had been taken off our ambitions completely. And as you say, that statement about the Catholic thing came up very, very early because it was good tabloid fodder. But also, I think it suited Souness to kind of make a statement that he wasn't going to kowtow out the Rangers fans, even if it meant they didn't like him. And we've seen that through the years, didn't we? He would do his way or the highway, and really it didn't matter what MD said to him or what MD thought. And Ali Dick, I mean, I don't really remember him as a player. I remember him being a player of great promise that never really fulfilled it at Ajax and Spurs. And he was always, even before Souness, he was kind of wheeled out sometimes as the convenient RC that could sign for Rangers. But it was an intent, and it was a signal to the support as well that you're either with me or you're not, because we're going somewhere. And we've seen that with the first couple of signings, you know. At the World Cup, and I mentioned earlier on the fact that we had Souness at the World Cup, so there was this anticipation that, you know, he was there. New stuff was going on in the background because the papers were full of it. Players like Goff were getting mentioned, but it started to go up a notch by my memory because we then get linked with, first of all, Chris Woods. We broke the world record for a goalkeeper.
Yeah, we'll come to that. Alex Cameron and the Daily Record Sunday Mail at the time, because Souness had told Chuck Young and others that, look, we are going to get some players in, but there's going to be a big one, like a proper big one, and he thought it might be the Brazilian Falcao. Now, he played at Rome at the time, and Rangers were going to be ambitious, maybe not Serie A ambitious. That was probably just slightly outside of that reach. But if the Scotland camp in Santa Fe was where a lot of the chat was, there was also chat about Rangers in Colorado Springs, where England were, where rumours started that one player had agreed to join Rangers. And eventually this turned out to be Chris Woods. Now, Rangers had inquired about Peter Shilton, and he said he wasn't prepared to move. But England played Scotland before the World Cup. England won 2-1 at Wembley. Souness scored and Butcher scored. And Souness had spoken to Woods that night and pretty much had the agreement in place. And yeah, it was announced during the World Cup that Rangers were going to pay £600,000 for Chris Woods, a world record for a goalkeeper. Terry Butcher thought he was off his head. why are you going to do this? You're jeopardising your England chances, you know, you're kind of next in line. And Butcher was the next one. Before England left, he was definitely going. He was leaving Ipswich Town that season. Spurs and Manchester United were in for him. Woods was pressuring him. Rangers were then linked just before England left. But Woods was pressuring him that the journalist from the Daily Mirror, Bob Harris, who was a friend of Graham Souness, was inside the England camp, and he was always in his ear. To be fair to Butcher, I think he wanted to put all of it out of his mind and just concentrate on having a good World Cup, which he did. And he played for the rest of the world, 11, against the Americas for UNICEF, the Pasadena Rose Bowl in Los Angeles. And after the game, was up in the Hollywood Hills having quite the party with Diego and all the other players involved. And he was very drunk at 3 a.m. when his phone went in his hotel room, and it was Graham Souness saying, "Can I meet you when you get off your plane in London tomorrow and we can chat about this?" Which they did. They messed up the hotel. Butcher forgot basically what it was, what Holiday Inn it was, went to the wrong one, Souness eventually found them. And I think, boys, that Butcher had in his mind that it would be a wee chat over some much-needed coffee to get rid of the hangover. He'd go back and have a sleep, and then they'd talk about it again, but Souness wasn't for having that. He got him on a flight to Edinburgh and then took him to Ibrox, because in Souness's mind, he needed to get these players to the stadium. Once they were in the stadium, he could sell Rangers to the players. Butcher's wife was firmly behind. She wanted to move the family up there, but he still wanted to go to Manchester United. And if they had made the offer, Rangers had offered £700,000 up front. And if United had done that, he said he probably would have gone to United. Saved by Bobby Charlton, who told Ron Atkinson he didn't need another centre-half. He'd enough there. Spurs wanted Butcher to come down and basically train for a bit to see. So this was kind of what he was left with. And to be fair, he felt that Rangers were great with him. Really good. He trained for a couple of days and then eventually he signed. He was staying at the hotel in Edinburgh, owned by a man called David Murray. It was used by Frank Bruno and other Commonwealth Games athletes, because the Commonwealth Games was, of course, in Edinburgh at the time. But it was done, Andy. Now, this must have been big.
This is where the eyebrows started getting raised. And there was chat about it. And I remember that UNICEF, was a UNICEF game. Did you see the charity game?
Yeah. The Butcher scored.
He scored. And I remember it vividly because it was live on TV and it was the night before my birthday, 27th of July, 1986. And you're watching it. And it was a friendly, right? But Butcher could pass a ball. You know, we know the big long raking passes he used to put over the head of Robert Fleck, and he was doing that in this game. And you're sitting there thinking, Christ, this guy could be playing for Rangers, but it was more than 10 again. Just like Souness, it was the fact you were getting a major name, and it had never, ever been done before. It was totally, even a matter of 3 months before this, it was total fantasy to think that we would be signing players from England, never mind signing the, you know, almost captain of England and a mainstay of the English national team for, by that point, a good 4 or 5 years. It was fantasy. So this is where things started to get interesting, because we thought the world was our oyster. This was proof positive that it was, because to get him plus Woods in the first couple of, you know, signing period was major, very, very big. And you allowed yourself to dream, because we were then thinking, you know, we're going for this here. This isn't us coming to have a wee incremental step up. We were going for it. So a major, the second, or maybe the third, I should say, because Woods was a statement of intent as well, breaking that world record for a goalkeeper. Mm. It was a third statement of intent. Souness, Woods, Butcher, and there you had Colin West as well.
Colin West would be lesser. From Watford, would finish the, basically finish the summer. But I'm interested in both, just continue this idea about intent. Alan, I'll come to you first and back to you, Andy. Because these are big signings, and you know, Souness kind of gave up in golf, and a bit of a parting shot. It's sad for Scottish football that, you know, our money's had to go outside the game, just because, you know, they won't play ball. Jock Wallace had, before he was sacked, of course, he was thinking ahead to the summer. His transfer targets that summer were Gordon Jury of Hibs, John Brown of Dundee, and Craig Levine of Hearts. Now, of course, Jury and Brown would eventually arrive and be good club servants. I don't think Craig Levine would have been out of place too much in that Rangers team in April 86. And I'm sure there'd be plenty around Scottish football that would have applauded Rangers for, again, putting some faith in youth. These are three young players at the time. But it's that small fry compared to what's just happened that summer, Alan. 84-85, Rangers and Celtic spent nearly £500,000 each. And with West, Souness, Woods and Butcher, you're talking about £1.8 million. David Hay kept getting assurances from the Celtic board that they would support him as well. In the end, he spent very little on a young Anton Rogan from Lisbon Distillery. These are very different summers. And I wonder, Celtic initially, and I think the rest of the country, paralysed by shock about what's happening here. It's as if they can't adjust. What were your reflections on that summer as a whole, just in terms of the ambition and, I guess, putting our money where our mouths were?
Well, I think a couple of things. From a, 23, 24-year-old guy, getting those players, obviously, as you say, you know, soon as kind of big Butcher and Woods, for a footballing point of view, it was like just, wow. Do you know what it was like? You know the kind of the young ones nowadays with the computer games or whatever. It was as if we had suddenly gone back to being, you know, like Glasgow Rangers, one of the biggest clubs in, you know, in Britain. Or after 7 years of just kind of going through the motions and so on, this was just like a massive, you know, it was like, you know, absolutely magnificent signings. But I think looking at it, so that was at that point, we were really needing to improve in terms of the spine of the team anyway, and in the midfield. So you've got three absolute crackers. Obviously, Big West potentially gave us the big man, little man. But I think what people really maybe hadn't spotted was that you mentioned it, I think, before, Martin, about visionary, and the fact that we had seen the opportunity of what was happening in terms of the English ban, you know, how long that may or may not have gone on. And I think even by him bringing in Woods and Butcher, I think it also sent out a big message to whether it would be guys down in England or on the continent as well. So I think two things. One, football-wise, yeah, absolutely made sense. And as I say, sprinkle some of them with maybe five of the guys that they had before, and we had something, which I think we'll see. But to me, that really was a biggie. The other three that you mentioned, obviously, in the previous time, that would have been, yeah, that seems okay, and it might make Rangers kind of move up a bit. But my God, this blew everybody out of the water, I feel. And it gave us such a confidence, you know, as well, because we didn't know as well that they'd pretty much blown their budget. So because you could sign at different times, in the mindset of us as well, it's like a, and maybe if we need someone else in September, October, we'll go again. You know, yeah, it's ridiculous, but fantastic, yeah.
And Andy, just a thought about Anton Rogan from Lisburn Distillery being Celtic's response to England internationals and the Scotland captain, European Cup winner, etc., etc.
Yeah.
Well, Anton turned out to be no bad player for Rangers.
He did.
No, I think it kind of epitomised the instant gulf that happened, and Alan's touched on something there where there was a mindset shift as well, because I know that Rangers fans or Rangers should ever have an inferiority complex, but it was more bravado than anything else up to that point. We were living in past glories, we were living in a name, we were a sleeping giant, all these kind of cliches were rolled out time and time again. And without kicking a ball, because we hadn't kicked a ball by this point, the signings and the statement of intent that we keep referring to here changed the mindset en masse collectively. So immediately Celtic were on the back foot, and the truth was that Celtic, if they had the money, then you know it was the days of the old board and dubious ticket and or dubious gate receipts, all this kind of stuff.
Very round, I mean, very round numbers that they
yeah, but the fact is they were going to go for a tilt at the European Cup, you know, and it was all European Cup. So that time when clubs like Rangers and Celtic, if they go into the European Cup, it was a knockout cup. Anything was possible. Before you knew it, you could be in the quarterfinal, semi-final. So it wasn't beyond the realms of possibility of doing stuff in Europe. But I don't know what happened at Celtic that summer, because either it was a case of we're good enough, we don't need to do more, but I think it was more penny pinching and the fact that they knew it was an arms race that they couldn't compete with when they seen what we were doing.
They would respond, though, we will get to 87, 88 in due course. But my reading of, in terms of the research I've done, is my reading correct that they just looked like they've been shell-shocked? Because Scottish football has been turned upside down. We do not buy players from England. The best talent goes to England. It does not come this way. And David and John and I, in the prologue show last week, talked about, you know, the opportunities after Heysel and the ban were there from 85, 86, but no one saw them until Souness. Not even the Rangers board, by the way. It was Souness that told the board, this is where we're going to spend money. Because Scottish teams will not sell players at decent prices, if at all. So this change in vision, it just looks like they got it eventually, and we'll get to that over the coming weeks. But this summer of 86, no one gets it.
Martin, I think if you compare the sides, the kind of Celtic squad, even from 85, 86, the only additions really they had were obviously Anton Rogan, you mentioned, Tony Shepherd, Alan McInally and Derek White. So they were the only ones that were added. Apart from that, it was pretty much the same, apart from no David Proven, and I don't think Mark McGee played. But again, I don't know, like Andy said, maybe they just look at the arms race and think, my God, we can't compete with this, so we're going to sit at the moment. But they certainly didn't look as if we're going to react now and we're going to build.
What I was going to say, Martin, was that in business you hear of businesses being disruptors. They come in and they upset the apple cart, and the kind of the companies that have kind of dominated are talking. They're taken by such a surprise they can't react, and that's kind of what happened. We disrupted it. We broke the model that summer, and a lot of it was to do with the fact that we had that all-seated stadium or a stadium of note. That put us ahead of the game for a lot of clubs, and you spoke as soon as bringing players up to Ibrox. Now, if they brought players up to Parkhead, that's not going to work, because it was, as we know, it wasn't called the piggery for nothing. But the culture change is not something you can just flick a switch on. Mm-hmm. And Celtic didn't have the same personality that was flooding through Ibrox and Souness and Smith, I suppose. They didn't have that. They still had Davy Hay, one of the old guard, fairly, you know, timid personality. Yeah.
And here's
that
another...
was just not a possibility of doing what we've done.
Here's another thing I'd like your quick thoughts on, and then we'll move ahead, but is something that John and David and I discussed last week, that one of the central things that had that did happen that had to happen for all this this revolution to take place hasn't happened at Celtic at this moment in time, which is a clear authority in the boardroom.
Yeah.
You've got still got family blocks that are big enough that, that just slow things down, and you've got stasis, and you can't react quickly. They cannot adapt quickly to a Rangers board that is really led by the chief exec, who has been empowered by a majority shareholder for the first time. So there's no endless board meetings about meetings about meetings. You know, Campbell Ogilvie said that previously they'd have a board meeting every week, even if there was nothing to talk about. It was just things get too slow and cumbersome. And Rangers, in keeping with everything that was going on, I guess, in the southeast of England around this time, keep that in mind, now in a boardroom that was far more streamlined. And Celtic were still in that old, quite stodgy, bogged down dynamic. That's how I read it anyway, Andy. Is that fair? That even if they wanted to react, because he wanted the board to spend some money. Because clearly, I go back to that Glasgow Cup week, he can see something changing here, but they can't. They just look, as I said, they look paralysed.
No, you're 100% correct. Celtic were run by committee. Rangers had either consciously or subconsciously moved to an executive decision model, but with a guy at the helm in Souness who kind of straddled both, right? Because as we've seen in the years went by, he became a director and that kind of stuff, but the connection between David Holmes, as it was at that time, and Souness and the vision shared there was so clear and so fueled by ambition that, as I say, Celtic could not move fast enough to replicate or even come close to replicating it. So you're 100% correct.
We're going to talk about this culture change then at Ibrox. And you'd mentioned, Andy, about Souness not caring about the signing policy. There's a few other things he didn't care about. On the field, quite clearly, in the pre-season tour of Germany, West Germany as it was, and all his chat was playing from the back. The influence was Liverpool on the field and patience. And he said, I expect to be criticised for the way we play, but it's my way and I'm not about to change it. In some ways, it's almost a re-education, because in my view that Scottish football in general has gone nowhere for years. We lost 2-0 to Bayern Munich at Ibrox, this was kind of glamour friendly, and drew 1-1 at White Hart Lane for Paul Miller's testimonial for Spurs. And he sees that there's some progress. The players are thinking more about the game than they used to. Sometimes they've tended to play with the heart rather than the head, but we are changing that. On the field, I'll go to Alan first on this playing style. This very aggressive, very quick modernisation of the way that Rangers are going to play.
Yeah, and it was noticeable even, you mentioned the Bayern. I remember the Bayern friendly. The one thing as well was, I mean, Terry Butcher, my goodness, Rolls Royce. You know, but the way we were doing this using the ball. You know, it wasn't a case of just 100 mile an hour, just lump it up. There was, you could see right away. Now, obviously, Walter Smith would have a wee bit of that one as well. But the fitness too, we just looked that bit sharper, despite people talking about, you know, Big Jock gets them all around Gillen and so on, and Rangers will run teams off the last 10, 20 minutes or so. But even fitness-wise, we seem to just look that wee bit sharper as well, and kind of more one-touch stuff as well, Martin, and just moving the ball quicker. So certainly the first impressions were really positive, you know, for myself, compared to what we've been watching previously.
Yeah. Interesting you mentioned fitness there, because Andy, off the field, the inspiration is Italian. It's those years in Italy, that year in Italy that Souness has had. And yeah, the Jock Wallace thing, and there's this fit Rangers team, ultra fit. Mm-hmm. Souness is 33 years old, and he is fitter than anyone else in that team. So the kind of sadistic sand dune thing is binned. It's more nuanced, professional, modern techniques from Italy, double sessions, a lot of what with the ball, and silly things. Being in the hotel the night before a game, flip-flops now compulsory so that, you know, the feet don't get ruined, no golf because, you know, they need the players 100%. Jacuzzis and saunas, proper washing machines. The club suits now are Manny rather than Slater's. And you know, Ian Durant said, like, you know, he knew football players were creatures of routine. They wanted to be looked after well so they could give their best, and he transformed the place from the bottom up to make sure it worked that way. Those added pieces of professionalism sound trivial, but they mattered. And I guess, going back to what Smith found when he turned up, Andy, when you have a decay at a club, it's the little things that go first, and it's the little things that are quite easy to bring back very quickly.
Italian football was the shining city on the hill at that point, wasn't it? And as soon as came back, an evangelist for it. And if we think to, I mean, we obviously have Rangers TV, wall-to-wall coverage, and at that point, what you were devouring was the Rangers news and minuscule snippets you might see on the news. And I remember vividly that, you know, the first training session, or one of the first training sessions, and it was probably Jordan Hill that were training it, and it was in the sun, and as soon as he's leading it, and he's doing stretches that we've never seen before.
Yeah.
You know, and you spoke about the flip-flops here, Martin. They're talking about pasta, you know.
Yeah.
And this is where the influence of the Soonest Revolution goes beyond just Rangers, because it changed Scottish football. I went out, I'm 10-year-old, 11-year-old, I'm like, come on, Mum, I need to get a pair of flip-flops.
Yeah.
I'm walking through the house in fucking flip-flops, it's freezing. Yeah. I kicked him off, he went through the front window of the house, that's a true story. So there's things like that happening at grassroots level because people are looking at football, Scottish football, differently. And it's went from kick and rush to this it's not like what we've got now, but there was a more thoughtful approach to how you build up the play. And Alan's exactly right. I vividly remember the Bayern Munich game. We're playing a top team. We want to see Butcher. There was grumbles. I remember there being grumbles running about us and people saying, shut up, because this is the way we're going to play them.
Yeah,
you know,
yep.
There was a people that wanted a kick and rush up the park, and then there was people that said, no, this is changing and we need to get used to it. So it was a really, really interesting time and actually quite pivotal in modernisation of Scottish football.
Jimmy Sanderson from Radio Clyde, the man who I think made famous Where You At the Game caller, also had a column in the Evening Times. And this is 2 weeks before the first league match of the season. He says, it's obvious that the Souness and Smith regime know the score, but they will now find that the honeymoon is over. It's 2 weeks before the season and the honeymoon's over. So it's a bit of hysteria, but there was one part of that editorial that Souness would have done well to pay heed to. Our domestic game for him is a minefield that is booby-trapped with problems. He will have, with Smith's help, to adapt fast and accurately. Fast forward then, gentlemen, to Easter Road on the first Saturday of the season. A beautiful, warm, glorious, sunny afternoon. And the hype is pretty huge. We'll come to the moment the game's probably remembered for in a moment. The football in that first 45 minutes probably typifies a lot of what we would see from that first half of the season from Rangers. There is good stuff. There is patient play. If there are long passes, they're probably sprayed rather than punted as they may have been before. There's purpose to it. The Rangers goal was a penalty scored by Ali McCoist, the first official goal of this era. And the play between him and West to win that penalty is genuinely good and intelligent and graceful. But there's so many errors. The two goals that Rangers concede either side of that McCoist equaliser, it's comical defending. Terry Butcher, this much hyped, expensive England international, England captain, gets caught under a ball. Woods doesn't look particularly clever either. And Rangers are 2-1 down at halftime, and that's how it would stay. But as we know, and as we're about to hear now, that is not what the game is most remembered for.
Good play from Souness. Immediately under pressure, though, from Beattie. Well, that's an aspect of the Scottish game with which Graham Souness may not be familiar. And tempos have gone completely now. McCluskey and Beattie, Souness is in the heart of it. Chris Woods wants to take his own kind of action. And this is a dreadful scene inside Easter Road. And off the ball, more trouble as Mark Fulton goes down. A collision with Colin West. And now the hip players turn their attention on the former Watford striker.
Now, Graham Souness may be in severe trouble here. He's already been booked, remember. Well, the game has been simmering right from the start. A flashpoint was perhaps inevitable. We've seen it now, and what action will be taken by referee Delaney? The Hibs supporters going wild on the far side, but the red card has been shown to Graham Souness. Graham Souness has been ordered off, and Easter Road is going wild.
Okay, Ali McCoist, and his 92 book says, it's some very inflammatory shouts from McCluskey right at the beginning of the match went a long way to creating the atmosphere in the park that day. It's one of the nastiest games that I've ever played in. I've never, and I mean never, seen a team so fired up against us as Hibs were that afternoon. We'll get to the incidents in a moment, Alan and Andy, but I'll ask you, Andy, Alan, first. Even in the highlights, it does come over that there's a very thick air of tension and hatred around Easter Road that day, because I guess Rangers were very much there to be shot at.
Yeah, obviously with a wee bit of history in terms of, you know, playing Hibs Easter Road or whatever, so we never really got on that well. But this, because of the Souness coming, and to be honest with you, I think even before we actually got Souness in charge, there was quite a lot of even Rangers fan going, look at this guy. He thinks he's, you know, he would eat himself kind of thing. You know,
respected, not loved.
Yeah, absolutely. And then the minute it obviously came to us, suddenly became a he's our guy, and my God, we loved him. But I think that obviously the rest of Scottish football will be, who the hang does this guy think he's coming? Oh, Rangers think they're going to. So in a way, it was almost as if they'd kind of targeted them. There was a, oh, you bloody think so attitude. And you could tell even before the game started, I don't know, the atmosphere in there, it just seemed just that wee bit more, you know, intense. I think even in terms of playing the game too, we tried to play that kind of nice, deliberate passing. But that's the other point I think I wanted to make on this one. To me, it's the classic. We know we get players coming from England or from elsewhere. And it's another thing being able to, in the hurly-burly, to be able there to mix it, to try and, you know, keep controlled and so on. And they will eventually get to it. I think we just obviously get caught up. And Graham Souness has been the guy, quite rightly, if I was in the middle and people were coming for me, what's he going to do, Martin? Is he going to back down? I don't bloody think so. Now, I know his dad and David Holmes and all that would say you maybe do it differently. But in a way, I think him standing going, I'll give you as much. And I think as well, what was really good for me was the fact that all of the Rangers players get right in about it too. And I think at the end of it too, I remember maybe reading even the next day or soon as making some quote about, yeah, you might occasionally, they'll beat us, but my God, when it comes to fighting and so on, if people, and that was good too. You know, added to that point about, we used to talk about, you know, we've got this kind of legacy, we've got this history, you know, the famous Glasgow Rangers. But to me, that just added another wee bit too, which gave us confidence as well, you know, going forward. But no, I would imagine, okay, you get it with the Old Firm games, but my God, I mean, this was probably worse than Pittodrie, you know, the way it is now, yeah. Martin, yeah?
Yeah, oh, it just seemed absolutely visceral. Andy, I think there's a preemptive strike, because Smith has warned Souness, hasn't he? Who to kind of get? And I think he gets the wrong guy, doesn't he? Really, but he's a preemptive tackle on Billy Cup. It's an outrageous tackle, and he gets booked. And he's almost smiling as he gets booked because he knows what he's doing. He knows what's coming. Then it starts to increase. Chris Woods is kind of bundled, kind of 1930s style, a corner by George McCluskey. And again, a lot of blue shots around, demanding action, and it's starting to get a wee bit hot. And then the incident itself, soon as tackled by Stuart Beattie, he should have gone down. I mean, he would have got a free kick. It was a foul. But he stays on his feet, he careers then into McCluskey, does a melee, and he kicks out. And the gash needed 9 stitches. And he's obviously sent off as McCluskey's carried off that famous photo. He's kind of smirking, and then he does see his dad in the main stand, kind of looking down, shaking his head. And soon as said it's, you know, the worst moment in his professional career. as Alan says, the entire Rangers team, nearly both teams, because I think Alan Ruff was the only one who stayed out of it, got involved. Rangers were fined £5,000 and Hibs £1,000, and a straight red for the new Rangers manager. Not for the first time, he kind of apologised for his own actions, but had a pride in the fact that his team kind of rallied round. You weren't at Easter Road that day. I was in Mallorca on holiday. My dad phoned home, yeah. And a sense of deflation, really, that after all that excitement, we'd lost. The new guy was losing the head, going around, you know, assaulting people and whatever. Butcher could have gone off, easily could have gone off in the second half with an elbow. Can you remember the feelings that tea time?
I can. My dad was at the game, so he got to go. I think I listened in the radio because that was all you could do then. And just before I go into the game, but this was how much of fever pitch Scottish football had reached because of the anticipation for the new Rangers. And Souness was a lightning rod for it. And to be honest, he couldn't handle it. A couple of times this season, he couldn't handle it, as you say. But for that game, my dad came in the door, so I've listened and it's happened. I'm super disappointed. I don't really get any other context than the result. My dad came in the door that day, and as he would, I'm jumping up and saying, what was it like and what was this? And my dad was effervescent with enthusiasm because of the fight and the fact that, you know, for lack of a better phrase, no surrender spirit was there. And there were glimpses of, despite the mistakes by Butcher and the confusion defensively, you know, you could see, Alan referred to him as a Rolls Royce in that Bayern Munich game. You could see he was for a different planet, otherwise, you know. So that anticipation of what was round the corner as a Rangers supporter was still there. And this was kind of a blip. It was quite a sore blip, quite a big blip. It wasn't expected. It was a shock. But we now look back at that, man, and you think, well, could it have been anything thus? Because it was probably proof positive that, you know, Rangers are always the big fish to be, you know, captured or whatever, caught. That just went up tenfold. And Hibs's reaction and attitude towards Rangers that day, if any of our players, or Souness, in fact, ever thought, you know, this was going to be a cakewalk, they realised that it wasn't going to be. It was the first stage of Souness acclimatising to the proper way of thinking, right? Because you've alluded to it, Martin, that he was kind of pragmatic. He was so arrogant that he thought, you know, it's just another 3 points in an Old Firm game. I remember him saying that, and I was thinking, no, you're completely wrong there. It was things like that. He would come out with, and you're like, right, well, actually,
he'd never been immersed in it. How would he know?
He'd been away from Scotland since 16.
Yeah. And it's that's the adjustment, and it's a fascinating adjustment. It was a huge blow. Ian Durant said, you know, the dressing room afterwards was silent, stunned. We'd been billed as invincible, and we believed it. Souness and Butcher were staying at the, you know, Norton House, as I said, in Edinburgh, went out to drown their sorrows, met someone who had a better day than they did, and someone was basically winding Souness up, and Graham told them to fuck off before Terry Butcher thought, that's probably enough for the night, gaffer. We're getting in a taxi and getting back to the hotel. We're going to hear now from the man who really showed that leadership on the Monday, David Holmes.
People thought I was just starting, but yeah, I'd been at this for some 12 months before that. And, you know, in 37 minutes I watched the 12 months work going out the door. But I came to terms with it over that weekend. You know, Betty and I went home and we shut the door and we didn't go out. I didn't come anywhere near anyone until the Monday when I came back in here. But by that time, I had actually come to terms with what had happened, and I had accepted all the criticism in the paper and on the media, and I was resolved to start again as from that particular day. And the first thing I did was call a meeting with all the lads, and I put it to them where I stood and where they stood and what I expected as from now.
And there's just something understatedly authoritative about David Holmes, Alan. He felt it. And he said, you know, as you heard there, all this work, you know, disappearing after 37 minutes, shutting the curtains when him and Betty get back to their house. But came in on the Monday, told everyone what the score was and what was expected of them, and they have a target on their backs, and they have to accept that and kind of move on. He's a forgotten man, and I think it's a bit of a disgrace that he is, really.
I think so. I mean, leadership definitely springs to mind with him. Even, I think his background and where he came from and to actually get to the position that he did, even before he takes over this Rangers one. But no, to me, leadership was the big thing with David Holmes. I even saw an interview, I think, with Graeme Souness at one point talking about, you know, we're worked really closely together. We have the odd argument, but my God, you're never going to win one. So, no, I think he carried himself really well. And as you say, I think in history, certainly up to now, I don't really think David Holmes gets the recognition, you know, that he deserves, you know, at this point in time. But no, he certainly let them know in no uncertain terms. And to be honest with you, I think he was even the type of guy to let Souness know. And that said a lot about him, yeah.
Absolutely. Gentlemen, we'll wrap up there, and it feels like we're just getting started, which of course we have, but you'll both be back, I hope, as the weeks develop. Thank you, Alan.
No, thank you. I really enjoyed it, and just looking forward to going forward, but it's so nice to be in positive stuff now, Martin, isn't it? Yeah?
Well, indeed. There'll be plenty of clouds to navigate, of course.
There'll be a wee bump in the road, but I think overall, this is going to be really good.
It's going to be an enjoyable year. Andy, thank you very much.
Thanks, Martin. It's a strange experience to go back and think back what 10-year-old Andy was thinking, but it's quite exciting, actually, because it was a really exciting time at a Rangers fan.
Yeah, you just calm down when we get to 14-year-old Andy, please. okay, Ali McCoist, when talking about that game, said that the hostility worked in our favour, that totally united the squad in a them-against-us way. We had to stick together as a team, that was obvious, and the dressing room atmosphere was quite simply superb. The big-name boys and the lads who'd come up through the ranks mixed together perfectly. Well, later that season, and especially in later years, Souness would create a Rangers side that would win games and trophies by playing some beautiful football, but it simply wasn't realistic for that to happen immediately. Rangers have been a laughingstock and a punch bag for years, and now, because of their newfound ambition, they were an even bigger target for aggression. Souness said that weekend that Rangers would have to match the aggression because I cannot allow us to be trampled on, and I won't as long as I'm in charge at Ibrox. The lines then had been drawn from the very first battle. Like his iconic Liverpool side, the new-look Rangers would have to be prepared to fight as much as they were programmed to play. And next week, we'll see just how well they play, whether it be Old Firm or New Firm. Until then, bye for now.
We're gonna shout to the top, shout. We're gonna shout to the top, shout. We're gonna shout to the top, shout.
That was a Heart and Hand production.
Sports Social Podcast Network.